Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. Today we are going to be, well, we've got some interesting programming because we're going to go back in history a little bit. There are many of you, I know, that are listening to the show today that really are conspiracy theorists. Does the government keep secrets? What happens if someone is involved in a top secret situation? How is it handled? Goodness gracious, we have all kinds of shows on television today that really delve into the imaginings of what goes on. But today we're going to be talking with a man who lived through a period where secrecy was absolutely imperative for national security. And now, as a man of maturity, he is publishing his experiences, if you will. His book is titled Top Secret Flight. I want to welcome to the show Dale Cox. Hi, Dale.
Howdy.
Dale, you have a very good-looking picture of yourself on the back of your book. You're a retired Navy test pilot. You set two transcontinental speed records in 1957 in a Douglas A-3D aircraft, LAX, New York, LAX. And in 1959, you were one of 32 men to be tested for Project Mercury, the very first astronaut program. Dale, I want to ask you a question. How is it that at this time in your life, you decided you were going to write about this experience? Because this was highly classified. Why are you coming out with this information now?
I retired from the Navy after 20 years and went to work for the CIA. My case officer, who never opened his mouth for about 39 years, finally told me the story of when he was a captain in the Army Air Corps. He was in charge of modifying three B-17s to overfly Japan to obtain the photographs for the Doolittle raid.
What do you think made him want to talk about this? I remember working, in fact, it was a fellow broadcaster that had been very much involved in top secret intelligence. And I can remember this man, and he was in his early 80s. And he said to me that it really upset him because there had been an oath of silence that everybody involved in security had taken. And it was upsetting to him that people were starting to come out of the woodwork talking about various things that they had been involved in, whether it was the CIA, the FBI, the military. Why do you think that your friend decided to talk to you about it? I mean, after all, he could have gone to his grave and nobody would have been any the wiser.
Correct. His wife died, and after that, he was sort of changed. We had lunch in El Segundo, California, at least once a month, and he slowly told me about his life. He ended up as the third director of the Lockheed Skunk Works that built the U-2 and the SR-71. And he had that job for 4 years in the late 70s. Then he was a consultant to Lockheed for 15 years. After that, he had no contact with the military. And since this event happened in 1942, he felt confident that be no repercussions.
Well, and I'm very grateful that you decided to write about this. Now, here you've had this career in the military. Your friend is giving you what would have been considered top secret information, and this you convey in this book, Top Secret Flight, in such a fascinating way. These experiences that you are sharing in this book, did you interview other people that were involved? Are any of the other individuals still surviving from this that were involved?
No,
in that
I did not know any people, and neither did my friend Norm Nelson. They just disappeared. Completely classified. And, of course, the reason was the Navy was terrified that information on this photo mission might get out, and the Japanese would meet the Doolittle Raiders in full force and maybe sink an aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
We only had two operational carriers in the Pacific at that time. So that was the paranoia that kept the secret so long.
You have incorporated in this book a lovely love story, which I think is very, very nice. But you also really have a beautiful way of writing, and your description of the airfields and the interactions with people and what it was like for the pilots. Now, pilots at that time, the death rate was pretty high, I believe. And I know overseas, it was just in England, they lost so many pilots because they hadn't had time enough to train or get enough experience. As a pilot yourself, when you were listening to this story, were you able to relate to the difficulties that the young men at that time were experiencing?
Yes, I could. I felt quite familiar with their problems. And as Donna, is one of the interesting facts, those three airplanes were among the first to have superchargers, which meant that the B-17s that normally would not fly above 20,000 feet could now fly almost to 40,000 feet and get better fuel consumption. They get better fuel. And also, in my story, they picked up a jet stream. Nobody knew what a jet stream was, but anyway, the jet stream gave them was 92 miles an hour, which is not unusual for a jet stream, but totally they were just dumbfounded that they would have a tailwind like that.
I found it really almost captivating the way that you would go from one level of information to another relative to the pilots, how they interacted, how the government was responding to the situation, what had gone on in Pearl Harbor, because we're starting with, you know, we're in World War II. That's what your book is all about. And you start off with your book with Edward R. Murrow announcing from the House chamber in Washington, D.C. on Monday, December 8th. And the story went out because we were at war. I mean, they had attacked us. They had destroyed, so many lives and so much equipment. And that's one of the things that you go into in your book, is how the Japanese had, at that time in history, the people in power really wanted to have, effectively, world dominion. They had already started invading China. They had already been doing war with a lot that was around them. And there was, for all intents and purposes, various degrees of attitude, which I think has been proven out by history, by those who were in the military, who decided this is what we are going to do, and we're going to be victorious, we're going to have this, that, and the other happen. And there's one officer, I understand, a top commander, that said, we must be very careful how we move on this, because once we awaken the sleeping dragon, we will lose. And America was the sleeping dragon. You portray this information. And that is one of the things, Dale, that you bring out, is the resiliency, the organization, and the determination of a few in the American military to move quickly. And Doolittle was one of them. Tell a little bit about Doolittle, because this was an incredible man.
He was very famous before he went on active duty as a racing pilot, and he won several honors in that area. And then when the war started, he immediately volunteered and was put out to pasture, more or less, in Michigan as helping organize the army in Michigan. That's when the chief of staff of the Army Air Corps called him into Washington and said, here's this project. He was the perfect man for it because he was famous for taking risks and getting a job done and so forth.
A point of information that I found really captivating, again, I'll use that word, is how Doolittle came up with this, with the concept of sending these three planes to Japan to take photographs. Now, here we are in a world of technology where people are taking photographs every 30 minutes second, and we don't think anything about it. At that time, America, the CIA or whatever, did not have surveillance photos of the country of Japan, and Japan had very strict rules about going over their airspace. So they had really planned out well in advance that no one was going to know where things were located in Japan.
That's true. There was not a single aerial photograph of Japan in the United States on December 7th, 1941.
So you have this scenario, and Doolittle said, before we can do anything against this nation that has no qualms, at that time in history, about destroying us, we've got to find out more about where they are. And the preparation for the planes and everything that you talked about there, the planes that were used, there weren't any others around. These were three very special planes. And tell us the route that they had to follow to be able to get to Japan, because where we have these transatlantic flights, and we don't think anything about flying long distances today, that wasn't the case then.
You're right, Donna. And the longest flight in 1942, in the spring of 1942, was Charles Lindbergh flying to Paris in 1927, 3,700 miles. The longest flight any B-17 had ever made was 2,500 miles. They took all of the armament, all of the turrets, everything that wasn't essential for the photo recon mission out of the airplane and just jammed it full of fuel.
You have a traitor that is also in your book, a man who was in a very special positioning that had been approached by someone to spy. Now, this is something that anybody watching any of the CIA movies or what have you, you know, the Bourne, identity, the Bourne situation, and so many others that have come out recently, depict how there can be an individual in a very high positioning that supposedly is not a traitor, but actually will be feeding information. And there is a case on file where there was a chief of the CIA at a point in American history who actually was feeding secrets to the Soviets. You bring this out in the book. Was this based on an actual individual that was found to be a traitor?
No, what I was trying to point out was Charles Lindbergh and quite a few other Americans, loyal American citizens, were members of an organization called America First. They did not want to go to war in Europe. And they didn't even consider war in the Far East. But this gentleman that turned out to be giving information to the enemy was a member of America First, and his heroes were Eddie Rickenbacker and Charles Lindbergh, both members of America First.
February 1942, the chapter that you wrote on that time frame, you say with one of the characters, because they were trying to figure out what the messages meant in Japanese. They wanted to get the codes, they wanted to be able to translate them so that they could know what communications were going on. And you have a comment in here, fortunately, the Japanese are convinced, they believe fervently, that Americans are too stupid to understand their language. We'll stay ahead in this crypto game as long as they believe their own propaganda. And I had to chuckle.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. They were very arrogant and did not think the Americans could ever break their codes or understand their language. That was just the samurai arrogance that the top generals had. And Admiral Yoromoko argued with them that this was a false assumption.
Hi, this is Donna. We lost Dale. Something happened with his phone line, but let me share another point of information. The United States at that time did not have really an efficient or effective crypto analysis system. And after World War I, they started to develop it because in the First World War, which was with the Germans, they just failed miserably. And the attitude in the 20s and the 30s was that people don't read each other's mail and electronic spying just wasn't appropriate. So it's a fascinating bit of history, and we're waiting to get Dale back on the line.
I'm here, Donna.
Oh, good. Something happened to the phone, Dale. I was just sharing with my audience that in the 1920s and 30s, what we do today electronically is just incredible, and spying and checking on people's stuff is done all the time. There's no such thing as a secret email. And in the 1920s and 30s, nobody in the United States was really paying attention. And this is something that World War II really emphasized. And there were Japanese Americans that did volunteer to help do the solving of this crypto situation that they had. In fact, that also happened with Germany. But this with the Japanese, it's just amazing. And it was called Operation Magic. Was that the correct term that was used?
I'm not sure about that, Donna.
Okay. All right. So maybe that's wrong information that I have. But they were eventually able to decode the Japanese messages.
That is correct. That was what defeated the Japanese at Midway, because we knew ahead of time where they were and when they were coming and so forth.
With these three planes that were going to be sent to Japan, all of this was top secret. Nobody, but just a very few amount of people, less than a handful, were permitted to know what was going on. And Doolittle really emphasized this because he was breaking all protocols. He was doing something that was beyond the understanding of a lot of people. He didn't deal with politicians. He didn't deal with any of that. This was something that was really, really tightly controlled. And the pilots for this, now, how did they choose the pilots for this mission?
I don't know the answer to that, but they did. They had these big meetings down in Elgin Field in Florida before they went aboard the Hornet, and Doolittle told them, anybody leaks any information might be, you might get shot down and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, the planes were modified to a photo reconnaissance configuration. They were really loaded with fuel. The pilots were told that they were going to photograph major industrial targets. This had not ever been done before. And what ended up happening is that two of these planes didn't make it. Only one made it. And because of that air current, that enabled them to get there much more quickly, saved them fuel. And I absolutely was flabbergasted to find out that the Japanese actually saw the plane.
Right.
But they didn't,
I think that's an artistic license.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, that's what the book says, all right. I'm not sure that the Japanese actually saw it. I wanted to put that in the arrogance of the generals. They thought that the four-engine bomber overhead was one of theirs.
When you were writing this book, what did it bring forth with you as a pilot, with all of the experiences that you've lived through and with what you've done? When you were writing this, did you actually feel like you were living the experience? Because that's what is conveyed when I'm reading this material. We're having a challenge with Dale's phone. There is something that is going on here. At the time of that piece of history that we're talking about regarding the plane, the fuel, I mean, people were rationed. You couldn't get fuel easily. It was a big deal because everything had to go to the military. And these planes that were going to need all of this tremendous amount of fuel, there wasn't any margin for error. They really had to be very conscientious. Apparently, they used what they called a K-24 camera, and it had a tremendous focal length, which at the time, now we have to remember, we're talking about a period of history in the last century. At that time, it was the longest focusing, it had a 24-inch focal length, it was the longest one that was made, period. The only one in the world of its type. And it was able to record a 6x6 image and had an aero ectar of 178 millimeters with a special lens, and it weighed 21 pounds.
Have your guess.
Okay, but they had never really tested them. Dale, we're having problems with your phone.
Sorry about that. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, I keep hearing you all right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's good. Sometimes these things happen with our technology. Now, when you were putting this together, I asked the question and the phone line went wacky. When you were putting this together, were you feeling like you were actually living this time in history when you were writing it? Because you write it with such a personal flavor to it.
Yes, I had several friends here in Palos Verdes that were B-17 pilots. One of them gave me his handbook for the B-17, so the technical data in my book is out of that handbook. And then I discussed such a flight with him and got his input. So it was a personal mission to get this right.
Now, with this book, since you obviously have so much information in it, it's a fascinating read. It's like a James Bond novel, but you've got so much important fact in it. Did you share this with your colleagues and have them go through it and read it and tell you what they thought about it?
I did have one or two people. For instance, I wrote about the Japanese Americans, how they were discriminated against here on the West Coast, and I passed that on to several of my Japanese friends, and they agreed that that was factually a good part of the story. That was what happened in World War II, and I tried to bring that all out.
Well, this flight, which actually did happen, it was the first photo reconnaissance plane, first time to fly a B-17 at 70,000 pounds, first time to break Lindbergh's 3,600-mile nonstop record, first time to fly practically around the world, first time to fly over China using, which I thought was really funny in a way, a National Geographic chart, and it was the first time for the pilots to breathe 100% oxygen for 30 hours, first time to have a submarine assigned to a flight plan. It really was unparalleled in what it accomplished. Dale, do you have a website that people can go to find out more about your book and this history and you?
Yes, topsecretflight.com is the website that gives all the information about the book and my records and so forth.
Dale, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Do you have a final comment that you would like to share with my audience?
Well, I appreciate your taking the time to interview me, and I'm very, very pleased that you're an enthusiastic reader and so forth of Top Secret Flight.
Can you make a comment to anyone that might want to, might be listening, that might want to write a book on history using points of facts and information? You have a fictitious account here, but it's loaded with details of accurate information. What would you say to someone that maybe would want to do the same thing?
Well, the reason I had all the information, because I lived through it. I arrived in the Pacific in December 1942 and left after Hiroshima. So I was out there at the, having this experience during those 3 years.
At the back of your book, you have historical notes. You acknowledge that it is a fictitious book, but you have so many points of information, names of individuals that are being recognized in the book and where you got your facts. And I think that that's so important. It is wonderful that you have taken the time, Dale, to put this down. I never knew about a secret flight like this. How many Americans do? I think that
not many.
Not many. And so your book goes a long way to make the average American know that clandestine situations, well, they've been around for a long time, and it's not likely they're going to disappear. And sometimes there's reasons for extreme levels of security, and Top Secret Flight is a good story about why that happened, how it happened. And I love the love story, and I love the spy who eventually did go back to recognizing where his duty lied. I just think it's wonderful. I think you've done an incredible job. You're an excellent writer, and I wish you much success with this book.
Boy, Donna, you're a good friend. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Dale. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to come back in just a moment with a gentleman I think you'll find quite interesting, Yogi Raj. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hello, and welcome back. This is Donna Sebo. We're waiting for Yogi Raj to be able to get to the phone. And as soon as he is, we're going to be having him on the air. I wanted to let you know, those of you in Seattle, that this man is considered an avatar. And he is going to be doing a healing and enlightenment workshop in the Seattle area at the Asian Resource Center on Saturday, August the 25th from 6 to 8. Now, this is going to be a free event, and it's going to be interactive. He's going to be doing work with the audience. Donations are accepted. And then on Tuesday, August the 28th, he's going to be appearing at the Ascension into Light Foundation in Seattle, and you can go into their website, the Ascension into Light Foundation, and they'll give you all of the details. And then on Friday, August 31st to Monday, September 3rd, he is going to be presenting the Kundalini Kriya Yoga of Babaji, and this retreat is going to be held in Fort Worden, Port Townsend. And you're going to be able to learn about some very ancient Himalayan knowledge for self-mastery called Kundalini Kriya Yoga of Babaji. Now, if you want to get more information, you can go to sidhanath.org, or you can email events at sidhanath.org, and Sidhanath is spelled S-I-D-D-H-A-N-A-T-H.org. There's a phone number for reservations of 909-907-9605. This is a very, very special gentleman, and they have a fabulous video on their website for him. And as soon as he gets to the phone, then we are going to be bringing him on. I wanted to share a thought with you before we chat with him. And I don't know who wrote this, but the quote is, "Life is an adventure. Live it while you can. You can never have today again. Tomorrow only comes once, and yesterday is gone forever. Make your choice wisely, then live the adventure you create. I think learning how to be mindful about a moment and emotions can go up and down like yo-yos, depending on what circumstances we are living through. And someone taught me a long time ago to, whenever I get especially agitated over something, ask, is this going to make a difference 100 years from now? And usually the response is, no, it's not. So where are you going to put your emotions? Where are you going to put those feelings? Well, you want to use them as leverage. And there was a situation that happened recently where I found myself really getting angry. Has that ever happened to you? Well, I was just really, really angry. And then I said, wait a minute, how can I use this anger to leverage myself into getting a different result? That meant I had to implement a change. And when I really thought about the whole scenario that had evolved, I realized that I had been avoiding a certain change because I was busy with other things. I didn't want to be bothered with something I knew that I needed to let go of. So a situation evolved. The anger was the emotion that I had, and one of disgust. But I said, wait a minute. I had to take an action. I had to do something. So it's important that I take the action. And you know what's interesting? After I had those feelings and I went through my thought process, sometimes it's good to count to 10 before you really blow your top. And I found, all right, I'm finally getting done what I needed to get done months ago, but I kept procrastinating on. So I want you to know that it's okay that you have these emotions, but how are you going to use them so that it's going to have a good result? And what are you going to use to have clarity? Sometimes you have to let something totally go. Sometimes you have to implement an action for a change. And sometimes we really have to look at the responsibility we have in seeing things evolve. But as I said, a friend of mine said to me a long time ago, ask yourself the question, is it going to make a difference 100 years from now? We are still waiting for Yogi Raj, and I want to let those of you in Western Washington know the Ren Fair is happening. This is the last weekend, and oh, it's going to be so much fun. Costumes like you wouldn't believe. This is a wonderful family event, the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair at Bonnie Lake, Washington. So if you have a chance to come on out, check off for all the details, parking information, directions, etc. Go to Washington Fair, FAIRE.com, and you'll be able to get all the information that you need. Daydreaming. Do you believe in daydreaming? I do. I think it's an occupation we all should be able to enjoy and to experience. And when I look at this, when I think about daydreaming, as a child, that's something that you were supposed to do. It was no big deal. You'd envision maybe traveling around the world or whatever a child's fantasy might be. It's okay. It's wonderful. Well, apparently there's some research that's been done on daydreaming, and more daydreaming is being encouraged. You know, for such a long period of time, anybody that was known for daydreaming was just not appreciated at all in many environments, many classroom environments, many different situations. Parents said, don't daydream, don't do this, don't do that. But they're finding daydreaming is a form of visualization process, and it actually is a significant part of creativity. So in this research that was done, and this is a very simplistic explanation of it, said if you daydream about your to-do list, boy, who wants to daydream about a to-do list? You write it up. You really don't want to daydream about it, but there are people that might. Well, it means you're extremely creative. If this is something that you're processing, this is part of the daydreaming aspect, it may sound counterintuitive, but really, it has an aspect with creativity. Why? Because your subconscious tends to daydream about the mundane stuff when your conscious mind is occupied with more abstract thoughts. So what they've found, when you're daydreaming about ordinary things, it allows space in the brain activity to create ideas, concepts. How many times when people are under stress, they go out for a walk, or like a friend of mine bakes bread, someone else I knew scrubbed the floor, it wasn't a big one. You do things physically so that the mind has a chance to work through the solutions. Now, if you're daydreaming about love, it means you're youthful and idealistic. You love excitement, adventure, and having new events in your life. You have a passion for life, and you want to realize those passions. And if you're daydreaming about having time for yourself, being in that special place, well, you are wanting to develop your creativity. You really want to touch into that inner part of yourself that has a passion for something very special that's for you. Your creative dive, well, it's revived. That's where meditation is such an asset. And you're the type of person, if you give yourself me time, it enables you to develop your strengths. What about dreaming about success or power? Mm-hmm. This is daydreaming, remember. Well, you are a person that is determined not just to be successful. You're yearning to become independent and for inspiration. For you, it's not about money necessarily, but it's by working with possibilities. What's in front of you? What can you reach for? And if you love to daydream about traveling to exotic places, well, you're a person that likes to have big dreams. Yes, the daydreaming is a stimulus for the bigger part of yourself, for the bigger dream, the bigger happening, the bigger something. So daydreaming, can it have value? Mm-hmm. It's also a wonderful tool for visualization. Remember, nobody has to know about what your biggest dreams are. These are for you. And daydreaming and imagining possibilities and just reaching for something bigger and greater than yourself. To-do list, that's fine. But the creative spirit that's within you, through daydreaming, can be very, very liberating. So I just wanted to share a little bit of that particular study and research. This is Donna Sebo. We're still trying to reach Yogi Raj, and we apparently have not been able to get a call back from them yet, and as soon as we do, we'll have him on the air. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny. It will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now. Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic. Safe for children, too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo, and we do have our special guest, Yogi Raj. Yogi Raj, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's a delight having you, and I've been telling my audience for a number of days now that you're coming into Seattle. How long are you going to be in the United States, and what brought you to the United States?
Oh, well, I've come to the United States basically to visit friends and relatives who are here, and also as a part of my mission to teach the science of Kriya Yoga as taught by Mahavatar Babaji.
I watched the video about you and your journey, and it's beautifully, beautifully done. I was fascinated with how your particular experience with Babaji occurred, and this was something that you had been involved with meditation for a number of years. That's one of the gifts that you are wanting to share with people when you are here in Seattle. And I know we have the first event on the 25th of August of this month. But tell us how it was that you decided first that this was a path you were going to follow. What was it that stimulated you as an individual to follow this path of meditation and inquiry to become with Babaji?
When I was born as a child, yogis and other masters had predicted that a great yogi would be born to my mother. And I did not make any effort to practice yoga or do this path. It came naturally to me, and as a child of two or three, as you can see, I was sitting in deep meditation and going into states of trance and samadhi. So it was a past life carryover, and such people are called born siddhas. So if you come with certain perfected qualities, you have to make no special effort or need no outer motivation. The inspiration is from within. So I had already had practice of this, and I had this motivation from within from a past life. In India, we believe in reincarnation and past life. And therefore, without any effort, without any guru, I was still practicing. And I had visions until I grew up, and I had this intense and burning urge, which I suppose Babaji himself created in me, till I went to the Himalayas at the young age of 22 to 27. I was in that search where I went to the Himalayas, and where he blessed me to fulfill the mission of spreading the word of Kriya Yoga, the science of self-realization, to the world.
Now, you have traveled to many parts of the world, and I know that here in the United States, there are many people that have very intense lives and really want to be able to be more in tune with what I call the higher self. Some people would call it the God self. With the event on the 25th, you also have one at the Ascension into Life on August 28th, and then from Friday the 31st to September 3rd, you're going to be doing a special retreat. When people come to the event on the 25th, what are they going to be able to share with you? What is it that they are going to be able to experience with you?
Are you talking about the retreat or about the satsang which is being given? The 25th.
The Healing and Enlightenment Workshop on Saturday, the 25th.
Oh, the 25th. There I will give a spiritual kundalini transmission of kundalini shaktipath energy, and I'll be doing healing and give them a part of my consciousness, my enlightened consciousness, or my clear mind state of awareness. And therefore, I go around the world giving earth peace through self-peace, saying that there can be no earth peace without self-peace. And if people get peaceful consciousness, if they get an experience of the peaceful mind and divine consciousness, then they can get self-peace, whereby they can pray and meditate for earth peace. Earth peace through self-peace.
I agree. I think that that is so significant. And today we live in such difficult times. There is constantly put out the information about war, a lot of anger, a lot of disruption. And I think people around the world from different cultures that just say, somewhere we must make a change. Somewhere we have to be able to do things differently than what has been done because of the tremendous anger that exists in the various environments in the world that cause so much suffering to people. When this is done, and I do believe people make a difference by how they think and how they feel, when this is done, for the average person, the householder, how is this going to enable them to feel empowered? Because so many people don't feel empowered today. They feel like they don't have any of this power within themselves. How will this help change them?
Well, what I do at every satsang is I share with them my peaceful consciousness, and I make them feel and experience this inner peaceful power when I initiate or empower them into the science of Kriya Yoga. I literally breathe through their breathing. I literally do that. It's very difficult to explain. It's better to experience. And I tell them every day, my message to the common man is, look, I will empower you. You will feel the empowerment. But there are two things. Remember that in this world of froth and bubbles, two things stand out alone. Empathy in another's troubles, courage in your own. And that is the two wheels which carry you to self-realization, plus the spiritual practice of Kriya Yoga.
Well, I think that this is going to be quite exceptional. Now, on Tuesday the 28th at the Ascension into Light Foundation, what will happen there with the class that you're going to be doing?
I will send them into a certain state of astral light where they can feel a unity with one another, knowing that at the level of consciousness, light consciousness, humanity is one. You see, all my satsangs and my gatherings are experiential. So unless I give them an experience, it doesn't make a difference. They don't feel empowered. By merely talking and giving lectures like a sermon, it's no good for these times. They hunger for experience. They're thirsty for the truth through experience. That's what I give.
Well, Babaji, Yogi Raj, I beg your pardon, I made an error there, but Yogi Raj, what you are speaking of is so vitally needed in today's world, and I think that we're very privileged to have you in the Seattle area, and for those of you listening who are in the area, you can find out more about all of this. You can go to the Ascension into Light Foundation, and you can find out there. You also can register for events at nwevents.eventbrite.com. Yogi Raj, I know that your schedule is a very intense one. I'm so grateful for your being able to share some time with me today, and I'm looking forward to meeting you on the 25th of August, because I plan on being there, and it will be a pleasure to be able to share in the experience. And thank you again for being my guest today.
Welcome and thank you. God
this
bless.
Is Donna. You're very welcome. This is Donna Sebo. I know that we're out of time. I'm so delighted that you, as my audience, have been able to be with me today. We'll be back here, same time, same place, tomorrow. And have a magnificent day or evening wherever you might be in the world. Remembering always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.